Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Layman Auditorium. So a little bit different setup, definitely not our circles like Peter wants us to do. It's just, this is what was available for us, so we're going to make it work. So I'm glad that you're all coming down and finding a seat close here, so we don't quite have the close space like we did in Martin. So come on, there's still plenty of seats up here, over there. Welcome. Hope you had a good dinner. I had a chance to have dinner with two participants at Taste of Thai, so that was fun. That was a good thing about conferences, is having dinner with old and new friends. So this evening, our session topic is a vision for values-based engagement with the world. We'll have three speakers in just a minute, but our first speaker is a senior here at EMU, London Wheeler. London is a senior, and he has three majors: digital media, photography, and communications. And London is going to come and speak with us about what gives me hope in our chaotic world. So London, you want to come on up?
Good evening, everybody. I will say I'm a little out of my element. I don't ever come up here to speak. I'm always sitting in that spot right there playing a keyboard for chapel time. So those of you who are on campus probably know that. But yeah, my name is London Wheeler. I'm a senior here. It's a joy to be here in my final semester, so I don't know where I'm going to be in the next month or so. I should probably know that, but I don't. I'm just going to let God handle it. Well, he says they want to hire me as a photographer, hopefully. So as I stand here, I'm reflecting on my time when I was thinking about what I was going to talk about. And I was having a hard time trying to just think of, like, what really gives me hope in a chaotic world. And I was like, man, I don't know. Like, what really gives me hope? So after I thought about it for a little bit, I was like, all right, well, let me just stop and think about it, because, you know, our world is full of unashamed racism, community turmoil, war, poverty. A reality TV star / real estate mogul is the U.S. presidential GOP front runner right now. Like, goodness, what are we doing? But being a black young man in a society where Black Lives Matter movement is not widely embraced or understood, it adds chaos to our world. It adds chaos to my world as well. Being a 2-year-old in a car with my dad, who was being stopped because of the car that he was driving, having a flashlight flash into my eyes is unacceptable. And 19 years later, having that same experience for no reason, just because of the car I was driving. So, when I think about what gives me hope in a chaotic world, love. Love is the foundation of my hope in a chaotic world. So what is love? The New Oxford American Dictionary defines love as an intense feeling or affection. And on my iPad, I have a Spanish dictionary installed, so when I looked that up too, I was like, oh man, what does it mean in Spanish? And the Spanish dictionary defined it as, God is love. And I was like, wow, that was their definition. They didn't have anything else. All they said was, God is love. And that really spoke to me, because God is the ultimate witness for the definition of love by showing us love, grace and mercy, and forgiveness for us during our chaotic situations. If we are to be true believers of God, then we should be able to love and love unconditionally. So what gives me hope in a chaotic world? Love, which can provide compassion and give us opportunity to acknowledge faults, but allow forgiveness for our human imperfections. Love allows me to care for my biological family as well as my non-biological family. Love allows me to see a chaotic world as peaceful, because I know God has the whole world in his hands. And others like me believe that love will conquer hate. Love blinds me from seeing color. It blinds me from seeing race. It blinds me from seeing a person's physical imperfections. Love allows me to see the person and allows me to see the good in them. My charge for you today is to stand up, look around you for a second, and hug everybody that's in your little circle. Tell that person that God loves you, and so do I. How'd that feel? That felt good? So hopefully this gesture of love will continue when you leave this place and will provide somebody else the hope they need to survive in this chaotic world. Thank you.
Thank you, London. All right, so next we have three speakers, and I'll introduce all of them. Our first speaker this evening is Jeff Booty. Jeff is a 2007 graduate of EMU. During his career, he has worked for Oprah at her Harpo office in New York, which I got to hear about this evening at dinner, DreamWorks Animation in LA, and he's now the founder and CEO of JobSnap. It's a tech company focused on making hiring easier for millennials and Gen Z. So Gen Z would be after millennials. What is it, 20? If you're 20, are you Gen Z? Yep. And recently he was featured on NPR, so you may have heard a story about JobSnap and heard Jeff talk about his work there on NPR. After Jeff will be Dominique Bergender-Johnson. Dominique is a 2006 graduate of Goshen College and an alum of Mennonite Voluntary Service. She has worked in communications and marketing leadership roles at a number of national nonprofit organizations, including Director of Online Campaign Strategies for the National Wildlife Federation and Director of Digital Innovation for the Sierra Club. She is now the Director of Marketing at Goshen College. And then third will be Rick Castaneda, a graduate of EMU. Rick has dedicated his life to working with marginalized youth and increasing cross-cultural understanding in an increasingly diverse community. Rick has previously been appointed by former Governor Mark Warner to the Family and Children's Trust Fund to combat domestic violence. He is the founder of Men of Character, a youth program for Latino, middle school, and high school at-risk young men. Currently, Rick serves as the home school liaison for Harrisonburg Public Schools, which is a bilingual support position for ESL teachers, guidance counselors, administrators, and immigrant families. So first, we'll invite Jeff to come on up.
Hello. So thank you, Roxy, for that introduction. Much appreciated. I do have a little notepad here, but I'll try not to look down too much. What I wanted to do today was really just reflect on each of the positions I've had up until this point in my career. I grew up Mennonite. I'm an urban New Yorker who was raised from 2 years old as a Mennonite in New York City. And so as someone who grew up in a Mennonite world, from an urban community, and then coming to EMU as a college student, and then re-entering the world as in corporate America of sorts, and not following a traditional path, as many of my Mennonite friends have, I think I bring something a little different to the table when I reflect on our theme for a vision for value-based engagement with the world. And so I'll first talk about a story where when I worked at Oprah, I was in the business department, and in business, working for someone who is worth billions, coming from a Mennonite background, immediately I was faced with the challenge of of having so much green right in front of you, where you grew up as a Mennonite, people, the last thing you talk about is your money and, you know, how, your wealth, and those things are like the last thing that's mentioned. It's still that way. And so immediately I had to quickly learn how to be proud of where I was, knowing that I was in a position where I had to control millions of dollars. Again, this is right out of college. And how do I now, I'm comparing myself to my friends who are also Mennonite, who are also doing, who are doing things like cross-culturals and volunteer work, and who are doing great things, but here I am in New York working for one of the most powerful people, and now faced with just decisions that I never had to deal with. And one story in particular happens every year. Oprah will give a bonus. Now, it's not guaranteed. She'll give you a 1 week's pay, but it's happened every year since she's run her business. And one of the reasons why she's done this is because one of her former bosses, when she was just starting out as a low-wage employee, would always give her a check around the holidays, and it would come out of his own pocket. Now, again, I'm the new kid on the block. I have, my own set of values coming growing up Mennonite. And this year in particular, when I was just coming out of college, it was whispers, Oprah may not do it, blah, blah, blah. And as the holidays became closer, we realized that Oprah was going to give us that bonus. Now, normally, every year for the last 7 years at that point, everyone would just write a Christmas, send Oprah a Christmas card and say thank you. Now, again, with my values, I realized that that can't be all we do. Like, all we can do is just write a thank you note. Can't we do more? So now I'm in this environment where I'm the youngest one. I'm in an environment where you have some of the most powerful people in media, and I'm stepping up and saying, faced with my value of saying, someone's giving us a check out of their own pocket, and can't we do more to say thank you? And in my mind, I thought, well, how can we do that? And I thought, okay, why don't we create a video and let Oprah know what we're doing with the money that she's given us? Because Oprah is all about giving. She's all about reflecting and just sending her a thank you card can't be good enough. Like, I'm actually working at Oprah. How could this be possible? So again, like in this situation, I am now forcing people who are so used to just checking a box to now rethink about how they are, how they're saying thank you to one of the most, you know, our boss. And I was confronted with a lot of pushback. You would not believe the pushback. But I ended up, again, me being crazy, I ended up basically befriending Gail King, who is, if anyone you know, she's considered to many Oprah's best friend. And in this time, she took me in and said, this is the best idea anyone's had in a long time. I want to run with this, and I'm happy to support you in this. And in the courage that I had to step out of the normal, let's just sign a card and send it, I began to have pushback or get pushback from my colleagues who saw me as a threat for wanting to go over and beyond, where in my mind, it was just doing what was right. It was doing what I thought we should do more. And to the world of that world, it was, you're trying to now step on our toes by shining or by standing out. And I didn't look at it that way at all. But needless to say, that was one example that I was really, it really caused a lot of emotions for now growing up, Mennonite, growing up in the church, being faced with people who think you have ill will intentions, and if they don't have a faith background, again, I'm around Jewish, I'm around people who are Islamic, you're literally confronted with how do I remain genuine in what I believe should be done, if that makes sense. And so in fast forwarding now with my own business, through that relationship with Gail, you know, she's now become one of my mentors. But had I not stepped out to reach out to her when I had this idea, because no one around me supported me, they just wanted to do the normal, I now have someone who supports the business that I'm doing now And once, and when I'm ready, you know, she's on CBS This Morning as an anchor. And when I'm ready for that platform with my business, I haven't asked her for anything in 7 years, 8 years. And this is the first ask, now that I have my own business, say, hey, I'd really love it if I can get a spot on CBS This Morning. This is what I'm passionate about, et cetera. And now that's come to fruition. But I couldn't have seen that, you know, when I first started out. That wasn't my intention either. But that's one story. And then after I left Oprah, which many people thought I was crazy for doing, I went over and flew out to L.A., which is where I'm currently based. And in L.A., again, another place where there aren't too many Mennonites, Lauren was there, the president, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and we had a meetup at one of our alums' houses, and there were about 10 of us. And I was like, wow, there's 10 Mennonites. There's at least 10 of us in L.A. I had no idea. This was amazing. Where were you? Where did you guys come from? This was literally like eye-opening, because when you live in West Hollywood, it's just I go to a non-denominational church because the Mennonite community isn't really, you know, prevalent there. So just having Lauren there and having to realize that there are Mennonites in L.A., we're all over the place, spread out, but it was such a warm, it was a warm feeling to realize that there are people who've migrated west. Needless to say, moving to DreamWorks and working at DreamWorks, one of the situations that I faced, again, a wonderful place, if you've ever been or if you ever want to go, please let me know. I still have relationships there. It's a dreamland. You know, they give you free food. You have a game room. You have almost free health insurance. You're probably paying 10 bucks a month. You have just all these perks for working at, when it comes to tech and leadership, because DreamWorks creates some of the best films when it comes to animation. They have all these perks to attract the most talented people. But yet, at the same time, which is amazing, so you're wooed in. But one of the situations that I face, having come from the Oprah world and then jumping into another wonderful place, was that I felt, for me personally and the group that I got plugged into, a situation that I had to confront was I felt undervalued. And I don't know if anyone in this room has ever felt undervalued, where you feel like you can do more than what you're paid to do. And I think that's something I've always struggled with, is that I've never been the one to just do a job. I've always wanted to go over and beyond. And in this particular role, I realized that in thinking about my values, that I wasn't going to play the gossip, the politics, the, you know, all the things that it took to be favored in this environment, in this group. I was just not going to play that game. And I think it was, again, another situation where I realized where my values were. Because sometimes I think it takes a situation like that to allow you to recognize where your values are, where you're like, that's something I don't want to do, and I could get fired for that, or it's going to cause a strain, or it's going to do X, Y, Z. And working at DreamWorks in this particular group, I was confronted with playing the politics or not. And I knew that since I couldn't play the politics because of my values, that I was going to not last there long. I knew that I had a shorter time frame of how long I could last, knowing that I was going to be an anomaly. I wasn't going to play the game. I was going to think differently. And thus, my supervisor at the time, you know, maybe within 10 months, you know, her and I had a chat, and she said to me, you know, we really like you, we really like this, but I think you'd be a better fit somewhere else. And I agreed. And so we both agreed. I think the good thing about DreamWorks is that they allow you that creativity to figure out where you want to go next. And in having that conversation with my supervisor as an adult, I realized that I was not going to be the best fit at DreamWorks in that department. And so I got recruited by a startup, and that startup led me to my current startup. And my current startup is called JobSnap. It's basically a video swiping app that saves both candidates and recruiters time. So I'm focused on Generation Z. I'm a millennial. Generation Z is 22 and under. So that generation doesn't know a world without computers. They have had the cell phone since they were 7 or 8. and then the smartphone since early teens. So really excited about Gen Z. The story I have when it comes to value-based engagement would be raising capital. Raising capital is one of the hardest things to do. Again, back to money. As a Mennonite and just as a Christian, I think the church faces this a lot when it comes to tithing. When I'm a tech company, I'm the head of a small startup, a small business. I'm in LA, Silicon Valley, one of the wealthiest group of tech people creating crazy ideas, crazy things that we all use or have in our pockets, whether it's Samsung or an iPhone, you know, and you have a ton of apps. It's all coming and being driven out of this one pocket out west. Again, raising capital for me was something that I wasn't taught. It's something that I had to figure out. It's something that if you don't grow up in the world where you have, when it comes to tech, if you have people who are constantly raising millions and millions of dollars, where do you start? And so I think as a Christian, one of the things I had to do was kind of ask God, how am I doing on time? Good. One of the things I had to do was ask God, how do I figure this out? Because I didn't grow up wealthy. My parents didn't own anything. And so they couldn't cut me a check. And again, this is about 7 years of being, so, you know, in the Oprah world, you're in DreamWorks, around a lot of wealthy people, non-Christian, Christian, all types. I have friends at this point that are at all income levels. And I'm learning a ton about people who talk about money, people who are wealthy. I'm in these wealthy circles. And I realized that my wealthier friends didn't have to take out a loan. They didn't have to go to the bank. They could ask family, friends, and could raise the 100K. They could raise the 250. But then I realized there was this huge issue with the system of, if you don't have access to capital, how do you get off the ground? You can have the best idea, but if you don't have that access, it's almost impossible. And so for me, when I think about the values that I've had to implement when asking for capital, Silicon Valley is not a value-driven place. People will do whatever it takes. I don't know if you watched the show. So I think it's Silicon Valley on HBO. It's just people will do whatever it takes to get money. And I think if as a Mennonite and as a Christian, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had potential partners who could put a million-dollar check in front of me, who I knew in my gut and in my heart would not be a great fit. But as a startup, again, you're raising capital and you need money. And what are your values? Where do you draw that line when, from the business side, it's the money which will drive you further to spread. But then from the ethical side of knowing that this person doesn't hold the belief that you want your business to hold, but has the capital, and you don't know where the rest of the capital is going to come from. It's really, really a tough spot to be in when I have friends who don't have those same morals and will do whatever it takes and are really successful at it when it comes to finance, because their line is a little more blurry, where I have a clear line of what I won't do for capital. And so I think, again, as a Mennonite who's been in the corporate world, who's now running his own company, I've kind of experienced in the world areas in my life where I've had to confront areas that people who are non-Christian who don't necessarily apply the same values, I've just had more challenges. And I'm grateful for those challenges because it makes me who I am, and it makes me stronger to know I can do it without compromising what I want my business to be. But I also realize with that, to some outside of the circle of the Mennonite world, it can be seen as, I hate to say it, be frank, stupid, because, you know, the risk of a business is always there, and money is what will get you to that next step. And so with that, you know, that's kind of the three stories I had I wanted to share. I call it, my company is socially responsibly investing, and so right now I'm in the middle of raising capital. So for me, it's exciting to be back because taking some time out to share some of what I've learned But, you know, if there are any angel investors, feel free to reach out to me after this. I'm definitely open to talking and connecting. So thank you.
Good evening. Hi. So it was about 10 years ago, almost to this day, actually, this month, that I graduated from Goshen College with a degree in both history and in peace, justice, and conflict studies. And I remember as a senior in college when people would, you know, ask me that oft-asked question of seniors in college, you know, about my post-college plans, what was I going to do next? That I would kind of consistently and confidently give this answer of, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but I knew it was going to be something do-goodery, that I wanted to do something to help better our world. And it was this, you know, very general and perhaps also very generic orientation that eventually led me to enter a year of Mennonite voluntary service after my year or my time at Goshen. And for many of you, this might sound like a quite predictable path for a young person graduating from a Mennonite college to do, who also has a do-gooder orientation, to do a year of Mennonite voluntary service. And I agree that that part of my story is fairly predictable, but really the story leading up to it and the story that would come after was not quite as predictable, certainly not predictable to me. And one of the reasons, kind of the story leading up to it would not have been predictable for me is that I did not grow up with any Mennonite connections. I did not grow up with any connections to Goshen College, and not even any connections to the Midwest, actually quite far from it. I spent the first 18 years of my life growing up in Germany, where my dad was stationed with the US military and where my mom was from, and raised in the Catholic tradition. And while I did grow up fairly confident in the fact that I was going to come to the U.S. for college, I had really no real sense or way of predicting where in the U.S. I was going to go to school. And I remember also as a senior in high school that I would often be asked what I planned to study once I did go to college. And my answer to this question was also actually quite similar to what I would say during my senior year of college, which was that I'm not sure what I want to study, but I know I want it to do, have it be something that has to do with making the world a better place, with doing good. And it was this orientation that first led me to study sociology at a Southern Baptist school in South Carolina for my first year of college, and that eventually led me to transfer to Goshen College as a sophomore, where I then studied history and peace, justice, and conflict studies. So now fast-forwarding again on to that first year after I graduated from college and entered this Mennonite voluntary service assignment. And during my voluntary service assignment, I had the opportunity to work really closely with the director of communications of a San Francisco-based international human rights organization. And it was really this experience that gave me the opportunity to realize that communications work was not only something that I enjoyed doing, but also was something that was really aligned with some of my core competencies and skill sets, and most importantly, that it was aligned with my core value of wanting to further social good in our world. And so often when people find out what I studied in college versus what I have been doing in the decades since I graduated from college, they ask, you know, what do those two things have to do with each other? How do they connect for you? And the answer is that because I've approached my work in communications and in marketing really rooted in my core value of wanting to do good in this world, that the two actually connect quite strongly for me. And so I'll talk a little bit more how they do. So, you know, for one, for me, communications work has not been about communicating kind of just for the sake of communicating with people. The fact is that I'm really not passionate about marketing. I'm not passionate about communications. I really couldn't kind of just do marketing communications for just any product or service or mission or organization. It's really important to me to be doing it for something, for a cause or a mission organization that I feel passionate about. You know, more than anything, communications and marketing for me has really been this powerful tool, a means to a larger end, a tool for raising awareness about, you know, social issues, environmental issues that are dear to my heart and that I feel are often ignored by mainstream media. And I've also seen it as a tool, particularly digital communications, where most of my focus has been, as really a tool that can be leveraged for not just one-way communication, but two-way communication and really multi-way communication to bring people together in really powerful ways across geographic boundaries and really to unite people towards collective action a lot of times for social good, for environmental good. And so then a second way that I found communications and marketing connecting to my values and training in peace, justice, and conflict studies is through the fact that, you know, what's fundamental to being an effective communicator is also often what's fundamental to being an effective peace builder and conflict manager. Effective communication, particularly if you want your message to resonate with your audience and generate a particular response from your audience, requires you to really truly kind of understand and step into the shoes of the person that you're trying to communicate with. You know, to really try and understand their values, their worldview, their goals, their priorities, and then to have your goals, your priorities, your message, really try and meet them where they're at, meet them halfway. And this is, of course, also true of effective conflict transformation and mediation, which requires listening for understanding to the other, to try and seek a common good, to try and work together towards a shared kind of larger goal. And then third, I'm also not able to approach communications and marketing without applying a justice lens to it. And for me, marketing and communications is not just about getting a message or a product out to an individual or a community, but it's also very much about making that product, that message, or that organization that, you know, I'm marketing really more accessible and inclusive. And I found this particularly important in my work with some of the country's largest and oldest environmental organizations, which have a history, a long-standing history, unfortunately, of being fairly exclusive and fairly inaccessible to a lot of communities in this country. And so I've really seen, yeah, communications and marketing as a tool to not sort of just promote our organizational message to those people who have not, you know, yet heard about it, but also to challenge the organizations that I've been a part of to figure out how they might need to reshape their product or reshape their messages to make it more inviting, to make it more inclusive, more welcoming, more accessible. And then finally, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't really give a big shout out to my training as a historian and helping to guide the approach that I take towards marketing and communications. You know, those who have worked with me often take note of the fact that I'm regularly the one in the room that is asking about the data, the one asking about what the data is showing us. What is the data telling us? And part of that is because, you know, I believe that building an effective and successful communications and marketing strategy needs to be informed by looking at the data, by the lessons of our data, informed by the lessons of our history, looking to what we've done in the past, examining what's worked, what didn't work, and why, and then really using that information to help inform where we want to go, how we should move forward. And I use the term data-informed versus data-driven quite intentionally, because while I believe that our strategies and, you know, our approaches, not just to our work, but to our lives, should be mindful of the lessons of our history, I really don't think that history needs to drive kind of who we are now and also where we could or should go. And I think our core values can serve us in really kind of a similar fashion. Our core values can serve as roots to the tree of our life, you know, really providing us grounding. But from there, kind of from the base of the tree on up, I think it's really important for us to be comfortable with growth and with change, with the unknown, open to the possibility of kind of new life, new blossoms each spring, and at the same time, comfortable with letting go of the death or diseased tree limbs that can threaten our growth a lot of times. And I wanted to kind of close my words here this evening with a reminder of a familiar phrase, a phrase that's probably familiar to a lot of you, and that's, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And from the experience of my own journey through life thus far, I found that values-based engagement with this world is not, you know, about any one particular college, I've been to several, any one particular field of study, any one particular job or career. Instead, our core values, those fundamental values that guide and orient us, can be applied in any context, really, and need not to be kind of limited to the models of our history, and they don't need to be limited to the presumed limits of our current context either. Values-based engagement with the world, as I see it, is simply requires being rooted in a set of core values that can be as vague and generic and perhaps simple as just wanting to be a do-gooder. Because really the point of these core values is just to help ensure that who we are can show up wherever we go. Thank you.
I started here as a student at UMU, so this is my alma mater, back in 1994, and eventually finished with a degree in management and organizational development in 2001. So yes, that's 7 years for my undergraduate degree. So I like to say that I took the scenic route through college, took every opportunity, availed myself to every learning opportunity that I could while I was here, and I found that at least half of those wonderful learning opportunities were opportunities outside of the walls of a classroom. So, for example, in 1996, along with a small group of Latino students, a total of five of us, and a Latino graduate student advisor, we started an organization, the Latino Student Alliance. That year, the LSA, as it's known, earned the Emerging Organization of the Year Award, and I received an award for a Leader of the Year. I think it was just, as the student organizations, community student organization that gave these awards. So I guess I would assume then back then I was feeling pretty sure of myself and probably felt that I knew an awful lot about leadership and values-based engagement. And as I think back about my 20-year-old self and knowing what I knew then, I'm actually probably kind of embarrassed now to think about the gap that existed between what I thought I knew about the world and what I actually did know. So, and really thinking about today, even today, what I can probably tell you about leadership and values-based engagement is not anything that you couldn't get from a thorough reading of a John Maxwell book or several Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. essays. So I think that the most value that I can give you today is not in what I know. This speech will not be an homage to Dale Carnegie and How to Make Friends and Influence People, and nor will it be a list of 5 or 7 or 21 things that, a la Maxwell or John Acuff, that represent a formula for leadership or success in the world, or even values-based engagement, which I've been tasked to speak about. I can't offer those success formulas or even how-tos. I may even contradict myself in this speech 1 or 2 times as I talk. So as it relates to leadership and values-based engagement, I think what I'm simply going to share with you is what I don't know. And we'll start with, it's up here too. So number one, I don't know, so I already said this, I don't know the formula to leadership magic as it relates to engagement with the world. I'm not that guy. I'm not going to give you those answers, so you can put your pens down now. You don't really need to take any notes from here on out. Number two, I don't know everything about everything. That is pretty self-explanatory as well. And number three, I don't know the story or experience of another unless... Okay? So let's start with number one. The first point, like I said, is pretty self-explanatory. All right, so I won't spend any more time on that. So the second point, I don't know everything about everything, and neither does anyone else, including the topics that I am most passionate about myself. Many of us make the mistake that leadership or even a person standing in front of the room that represents a leader of an organization or a group or even a movement, that person has to be the smartest person in the room, that person must have all the answers. I know that I used to hold that belief and an attachment to that myth about leadership and movement and connection. I still struggle with it today when I'm asked to serve in a leadership role, whether it be on a committee or an event or an activity or even come up to speak in front of a group, but I have to make sure I do my research so that I can make sure I tell you everything that I do know, and I can impart to you whatever piece of knowledge that I've been able to gather as I pass through the world, right? But if I am pursuing knowledge, then my belief is I'm not pursuing leadership, that I'm replacing those. The pursuit of knowledge is limited, in my view, in and of itself. And in and of itself, it's somewhat self-serving. So as Einstein once said, Einstein said, any fool can know. So the point is to understand. This understanding that Einstein refers to implies a process in the acquisition of that knowledge, the learning process. Einstein's quote, in my opinion, also implies a deeper goal of that learning process than mere cerebral gluttony. Right? He's referring to, I believe, the pursuit of wisdom. Einstein further said that wisdom is not a product of schooling, but of the lifelong attempt to acquire it. Scholarly pursuit, just for the sake of scholarly pursuit, in my opinion, operates often independent of the heart and devoid of the love of learning, right? In the aspects of metacognition, knowing how to know. So we must be in the work, I believe, in honing our critical and scholarly skills for a reason, for a purpose. We need meaning in order to foster the connection between our learning and our passion. And I think we as people of faith, we as Anabaptists, have always held to that. That's always been a part of who we are. Passion is generated by the exercising and the strengthening of that muscle in the middle of our chest. You must do to care. That's how we exercise that muscle, by doing. The creation and the growth of a passion within us is a result of the imperfect union of the head and the heart in the midst of the river of the learning process. So as we do, we develop and learn and grow. But for that to happen, as Mark Twain once famously said, we must never let our schooling interfere with our education. Right? So the process of, so I paid all this money to go to college, and if I skip a class, do I have to divide then the number of classes by my tuition that I paid in order to determine how much that class is worth that I've skipped? Or am I taking an opportunity to do more learning outside of those walls while I'm not in that class that meets at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I really haven't finished my assignment anyway, so it may not serve any purpose to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. So we, because as we are all aware, not all knowledge is obtained within those four walls, so we must do. The point, in the words of Angela Davis, speaks to this epistemological function of praxis. This is how we avoid those college years becoming the total self-involved feast of cerebral gluttony that I referenced previously. The other, even more important aspect of praxis, in my opinion, is that we must take the daunting steps to take the focus off ourselves, to get out of our own heads, the prison of our own heads, as I like to call it. I believe, and reach out and take steps towards relationship with other people, with other human beings. I believe that we are created for the primary purpose of relationship. That's why we're here. That's what I firmly believe. Relationship with our God and relationship with others. I strongly believe that the greatest sin of our existence, the greatest sin of our time, is selfishness. I say this because I know that I struggle with the affliction of self-indulgence myself. I have to fight every day with that voice in my head that says, it's all about you, Rick. It's all about you. What they said, what they think, even the speech that you're giving in front of a group of people in Lehman Auditorium, it's all about you. And I have to fight that, right? The greatest and highest form of praxis, in my opinion, is connection with other humans. Often, our knowledge interferes with our ability to be a true leader, to be truly connected to our values and how that engages with the world. There's an important piece of knowledge that we do need to be effective leaders, engage with the world, but it's not the knowledge that we assume we need often, I think. Thirdly, we'll go back to those. Third, I don't know the story or experience of another unless I listen. The lost art within leadership is, in my opinion, that of listening. Listening means letting others speak and share their stories, not their knowledge, per se. I believe that sharing our stories with each other is an absolutely powerful, unstoppable force, and it's where our authentic advocacy and leadership must begin. Conversely, listening also means shutting the hell up sometimes, often. No, not sometimes, often. Now, so if I was the type of speaker to use expletives in my speech, this is exactly where I would use an expletive to underline the the degree to which we need to shut up sometimes, that we just need to stop talking and listen. This is the most important lesson that I learned from the National Undocumented Youth Movement and my friend Isabel Castillo, who's also a graduate of Eastern Mennonite University. I had been working on a local level to advocate for undocumented families and especially students and young people within the school system for a number of years. I had a lot of experience and knowledge on this topic. I knew what I was talking about when it came to this. But I am not undocumented, nor is anyone else in my family is undocumented. I am Latino, more specifically Mexican-American, originally from Michigan. And I went to high school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Lancaster Mennonite High School. And I now live here in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and work at Harrisonburg City Schools. So that is my context. That's who I am. That's where I'm coming from in my experience, as part of my story. And to take that even, so that's to say, I realize that I am in no way a spokesman for undocumented youth. And even though I've been invited many times to do so, I don't answer questions in the media about the undocumented youth movement and necessarily immigrant rights. I try to avoid being that person to be the spokesperson unless invited specifically by undocumented youth or the immigrant rights movement. And to take that point even further, I don't even represent Latinos or Hispanics in the United States. I don't speak for them. You know, the only Hispanics that I represent are Mexican-American Mennonites who were born in Michigan and went to high school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and now live in Harrisonburg, work for the school system. Those are the only Hispanics I speak for. You know, I know what they think, 100% of them, right? As the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote about in his seminal work, Why We Can't Wait, and Letter from a Birmingham Jail, in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, he was chastised by several prominent fellow clergy members, white clergy members, that his decision to move forward with the boycotts and the sit-ins, specifically the lunch counter sit-ins, was unwise and untimely. They labeled him an extremist, and they asked him to take his fight through the courts as opposed to the streets. He was asked to wait. These members of the clergy were supporters. They were not critics. They weren't detractors. They weren't enemies. They fully supported the cause of desegregation, wanted to see the dismantling of the Jim Crow era South. And here was Dr. King talking in terms of pacifism as a form of social resistance, as a form of protest. And still these religious leaders, white religious leaders, were asking for more patience on his part. They asked him to use the powers that be, the courts, mind you, these were the same powers, the courts, that had been used to deny black Americans in Alabama their basic civil rights. So imagine if he had listened to them. Their advice was directly contrary to the experience and the desires of black Americans in Alabama at that time. His decision not to heed their advice probably was one of the most pivotal decisions in the movement's history, and to me is an example of strength that still baffles me. The type of leadership that was needed from the white clergy allies, was that of standing up when a moral imperative is presented, when it's then presented and pushed by those most directly affected by injustice, and then shutting up and listening the rest of the time. So stepping up and shutting up is the type of leadership that was needed then. So in light of the experience of Isabel Castillo and other undocumented youth, and in light of the example of Dr. King and the civil rights movement, I say to our brothers and sisters in the Black Lives Matter movement and our brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ community that I will step up and say, stay the course. Continue to fight the good fight because our country and our church desperately need your leadership. Don't stop. And as an ally outsider, I can just say publicly that in my opinion, your work is good, your work is holy, your work is right, and my prayer is that the Lord will bless the work of your hand. And now I will shut up and listen more to the ways that you will lead. So, and I should say, before I continue, that I do know some things. They're the following. I know how to tie my shoes. I know the Pythagorean theorem still, even though I've had zero use for it since graduating 10th grade geometry. I know the entire lyrics to the Hail to the Victors fight song, the Michigan fight song, Go Blue. And I know my story. I know my experience. I believe that passion always comes from a very personal place, as I said before, no matter how altruistic or seemingly selfless those passions are. Actually, especially altruistic passions, they must come from a personal place, a personal source of connection. So I will share with you a little bit of my story, real quickly. So my passion starts with this little boy. And yes, this is a picture of me. A much younger version of me with a much wider collar and much more denim in the vest area. But it's me. The smile on my face did serve as an adequate mask for everything that was going on at this stage of my life. I was raised in a Roman Catholic Mexican-American home. I was about 6 or 7 here, so about the this time I was living in Saginaw, Michigan, where I was born. My father had just been sent to prison. He was convicted of attempted murder, and I'm sure he had other charges of drug possession, distribution, and some gang involvement. Over the next 7 years, he was in and out of prison, absent as much as he was present, which, in truth, at that time, I was very thankful for because for his absence, because when he was at home, he was an abusive alcoholic and one of the meanest and scariest people that I have ever known. My mom was 16 when she got pregnant with me, and my parents had both dropped out of high school after that. So poverty, abuse, drug abuse, violence were themes that attempted to dominate the other competing values that were part of my moral universe at the time. The values that my father attempted to teach me as it related to manhood and masculinity were clear messages of aggression, violence, abuse, and objectivity of others. So at this decisive point in my life, I had to make a conscious choice to reject those messages. It was at a point later on in my life. And so I had to attempt to construct for myself from the ground up a new definition of what it meant to be male, what it meant to be a man, what it meant to be an adult. As I grew older and we had moved to Goshen, Indiana, I think I hit all the Mennonite Mecca points throughout my life as a Catholic. Moved to Goshen, Indiana, and my mother remarried, and she married a man who had just graduated from Goshen College and who had just accepted a position at a church in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And so I moved to Pennsylvania, being a Catholic, and started attending a Mennonite church, but it was a Hispanic Mennonite church. And so these were the first Mennonites I met on a congregational level, a Spanish-speaking Hispanic Mennonite. So I assumed all Mennonites were Hispanic at that time. I had no idea. So this was a major turning point in my life, however. I found in this church experience a personal value system that resonated with me. I found a path to an education in the Mennonite schools that saved me physically and spiritually. I converted to the Mennonite faith at 16. I attended the Mennonite High School in Lancaster, and after high school, I decided to do the next Mennonite thing, and I came here to Harrisonburg to attend EMU. So now, the junction of a low point in my life, a place of sorrow and abuse, and a high point in my life, a place of joy and empowerment, is a place where a major passion of mine was born. The sorrow and the joy equally important in the birth and the development of my passion. As Khalil Gibran put it, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. So because of what I've been through in childhood under my father's regime and the subsequent nurturing and training in the Mennonite church and community, I was motivated and equipped to start the Mennonite Character Program. Program focused on the unique needs of Latino middle school and high school age young men, especially those at risk for involvement in destructive and risky behaviors. So about 13 years ago, I surveyed the landscape, actually 15 years ago now, I'm getting much, much older. Okay, so I surveyed the landscape of the youth serving programs in our area, and I noticed that there was no one paying unique attention at that time, there are many now, but at that time, no one paying unique attention to the unique needs of Latino young men. No one but the Harrisonburg Police Department, but for all the wrong reasons. So I started the Men of Character program as a sort of anti-gang program, and I've been running the program going on those 15 years now, and it's one of the things that has given me so much joy and satisfaction throughout my short life. So from my sorrow has come great joy. Khalil Gibran again. Some of you say joy is greater than sorrow, and others say, nay, sorrow is the greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come. And when one sits alone with you at your board, remember that the other is asleep on your bed. So as I said before, I believe the source of our passions, our altruistic passions, need to be highly personal. We have to be connected to them, connected to the people and to the passions and to the people that are connected to them. To me, the greatest commandment has been a guiding principle in this area, and it's only recently that I felt a need to look at this commandment completely differently than I had previously. Matthew 22:36-40. Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So in this passage, Jesus tells us what we need to do pretty clearly. To love God first of all. To love others is next. But it's how he tells us to love others that hit me about 10 years ago like a truck. We are to love others as we love ourselves. So the word as can be interpreted a couple different ways in my view. Either it could mean to love others while we love ourselves, or to love others the way that we love ourselves. Either way, we are called to love ourselves here. We cannot completely and properly love someone else if we hate ourselves, if we don't forgive ourselves, if we don't love ourselves. We must love ourselves to fully love. We must. I've been driven to wrestle with myself and love for myself. I've been wrestling to embrace my gifts and my faults equally as a part of me, always seeking to improve myself, but I had to embrace my full self first. I had to stop feeling like two different people, one that I have inside and one that I let other people see, or my facade. So passions start from within. They have to. We cannot pretend to come to someone because we want to help them. That only exacerbates the sense of hierarchy or patriarchy and imperialism. Because we are better than they, we need to help them. I feel that we need to rid the concept of helping the less fortunate from our missional and evangelistic vocabularies. Until we embrace our weakness and our brokenness, we do not fully open ourselves to truly be of aid to others. Yes, we are blessed with different privileges, and we need to be aware of that. But we also each have our areas of vulnerability and pain and sorrow. That is the human experience that we all share. As Lila Watson, the Aboriginal leader in Australia, once said, if you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. We are endlessly and inextricably bound together and interconnected. We are created for relationship. One of the goals of the work that I do and the times that I get to speak in front of groups like this is to encourage our sense of connection to others. And it's very normal to be connected to someone else who is like us, based on similarities. That's human. You know, I don't fault anyone for that. But my hope is that we learn how to be drawn to others based on differences as much as we are drawn to others based on similarities. I believe that that was a challenge of the Tower of Babel, a major test to see if we can truly love each other, even when there are perceived differences that would seem to divide us. Only through healthy expression of our own personal sorrow and embracing of our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses, and our ugly side, and what we don't know, can we truly walk side by side with someone in authenticity, authentic leadership. That's what authentic leadership looks like to me. So I'll leave you with the words of Oriah Mountain Dreamer. It's a poem called The Invitation. It doesn't interest me what you do for a living. I want to know what you ache for, and if you dare to dream of meeting your heart's longing. It doesn't interest me how old you are. I want to know if you will risk looking like a fool for love, for your dream, for the adventure of being alive. It doesn't interest me what planets are squaring your moon. I want to know if you have touched the center of your own sorrow, if you have been opened by life's betrayals, or have become shriveled and closed from fear or further pain. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine or your own, without moving to hide it, or fade it, or fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own, if you can dance with wildness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes without cautioning us to be careful, to be realistic, to remember the limitations of being human. It doesn't interest me if the story you are telling is true. I want to know if you can disappoint another to be true to yourself, if you can bear the accusation of betrayal and not betray your own soul, if you can be faithless and therefore trustworthy. I want to know if you can see beauty even when it's not pretty every day. And if you can source your own life from its presence. I want to know if you can live with failure, yours and mine, and still stand at the edge of the lake and shout to the silver of the full moon, yes. It doesn't interest me to know where you live or how much money you have. I want to know if you can get up after the night of grief and despair, weary and bruised to the bone, and do what needs to be done to feed the children. It doesn't interest me who you know or how you came to be here. I want to know if you will stand in the center of the fire with me and not shrink back. It doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you have studied. I want to know what sustained you from the inside when all else falls away. I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you can truly like the company that you keep in the empty moments. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to our three speakers, Jeff and Dominique and Rick. So, Rick, before you said authentic leadership, I wrote down authentic leadership on my, right before you said it. Maybe it's because I'm a leadership scholar and I'm just a nerd like that. But I was like, he's talking about authentic leadership. And I think I saw that theme come out. So the topic was a vision for values-based engagement in the world. And I think if I were to sum up or maybe draw a theme of what you were saying is authentic leadership. So even when Jeff, when you were talking, how can I work authentically with wealth? Based on what my values have taught me about it. Your stories about Oprah and venture capital. Dominique, how can I work authentically as a marketer, selling things? I would do so if it promotes the common good, if it promotes a mission that I care about. So that's that authenticity. And very much, Rick, your stories about your background, what you care about. And I got this sense of call from crucible moments in your life of feeling the need to do something. And to live authentically is to give leadership to causes that you care about. So a lot of this vision for values-based engagement in the world is how can we be authentic in what we do? So what we want to do right now is we want to open it up to your questions and your comments. So we want you to reflect now about this vision for values-based engagement and this authenticity. We're going to invite our three panelists in London to come back on up here. And we're going to give you guys a moment to turn to the people around you to reflect on what you've heard about this authentic leadership vision for values-based engagement. What comments would you have? What struck you? Are there stories that you might want to tell? Things you've struggled with to be authentic in your leadership? And we'll have some time for some conversation. So while the panelists are coming up, I'll invite you all to take a few minutes to talk with those around you, and then we'll open it up for a Q&A. So go ahead. Okay, so if you could wrap up your conversations. And Dave has a mic, and Vernon has a mic on this side. We'll open it up to your questions and or your comments so we can have a conversation about values-based engagement with the world. So what happens when your values meet real-life situations in the world? Okay. John?
A short comment. I think Ori Miller would have been very happy tonight. Values-based education, work, it's what he was doing, it's what you're doing.
Or is there anything that resonated particularly with you about what any of our panelists or speakers said this evening? What resonated with you? What made you go, oh, that's interesting, or I'm going to think about that more, talk about that more? Oh, okay, back there.
This comment is directed at you, Rick. I come from a little bit more of a boisterous community, and I really had to keep myself under control when you were sharing your support for the people of color and the LGBT community in our church. And I really just wanted to stand up and clap and yell and hoot and holler. So thank you for your comments there. That's really all I wanted to say. But I enjoyed everything that you shared, all four of you. So thank you so much for sharing tonight.
I'm Mary, and I'm getting a little weary just from content overload. It's so wonderful. So this is the only connection my brain is making at the moment. But with this very last poem about the invitation, it doesn't interest me, .. It really ties back for me what Peter Block said this morning, which on the face of it felt a little startling when he said, "I don't care about your story." And I think this is what he's saying. I care about what's behind or underneath your story. So thank you for that, perhaps unintentional, but connection.
I think one of the things leaders are is inspiring, and I am inspired by all four of you. Thank you for sharing of yourselves tonight. Young leaders, values-driven leaders, it's really inspiring. This morning, a young man from Heston College shared, and he almost apologized for being an accounting major, speaking at an event like this. And I thought, boy, it seems to me we've gotten into a little bit of trouble in our world when accountants are not values-driven. So I think we need values-driven people in all of the different kinds of work we're involved in. And all four of you have talked about different ways that you've engaged the world through different kinds of employment and engagements. And I just want to celebrate the fact that we need that values-driven aspect of our lives to infuse everything that we do, no matter what it is. And we've had a history, perhaps in the Anabaptist Church, perhaps just in Christianity more broadly, that those that go into ministry or into nonprofit work or whatever else, that they somehow are superior. And I just want to celebrate what you represent, the four of you up there, and thank you again for sharing your inspiring lives with us tonight.
I was hearing a thread this evening in all of your comments of a sort of defining point, or at least hinting of one, where you were aware of this is the core values that are moving me, that are pushing me in certain directions that will guide how I act in my work and with people. Can you talk about, Rick talked a bit about this, how you came to those values? Were you just awakened at some point and realized this is what I'm about? Was there a person that helped you recognize it? Where did this come from?
Well, I can start out. Rick, I appreciate the challenge and reminder about authentic leadership. Because I'm not someone who tends to start sort of with the personal and then talk about how it ties to the larger story, but so yeah, I appreciate you challenging us to talk about that a little bit more too. Yeah, you know, I think for me it starts almost as far back as I can remember. I don't think you can be a person of color in this world, let alone in a country like Germany, which is predominantly white, and not have kind of a great awareness of injustice and unfairness, and so I almost don't remember a time where I wasn't aware of those things and then didn't also kind of feel like I needed to do something about those things. And so there's both that kind of my personal experience with that, but then also I think coming from a legacy of having an African-American father and just feeling a great sense of sort of moral and historical responsibility to continue carrying out a legacy of fighting for justice and continuing to kind of grow progress for African-Americans and people of color in general in the world. And so, yeah, for me, it really starts there.
I think for me, personally, my dad's not African-American. He is a native South American Guyanese. And so I'm split with my mom, who's American, and my dad, who's a first generation. I'm a first generation immigrant, half. And so I firsthand, like some of my Hispanic brothers and sisters who are coming across, and many others, experience the hustle of what it's like to have a first, you know, to have a dad who's here and who comes to this country for that better life. And many Americans have forgotten that because you're so generational. You know, everyone came to America for that better life, and that's why we're a diverse group of immigrants, essentially. But it's so close to me that I grew up in a household where I saw my dad work his butt off to go to college, to become an engineer, and to really work harder and not want us to work as kids. And I didn't understand what that meant. He's saying, don't get a job. Just the hustle of what the life he wanted to create for us so that we wouldn't have to struggle. He grew up in one of the poorest countries in South America. So that's one area of my life that really drives me now, even in my faith and in my with my morals on what is right, what is wrong when it comes to work ethic and seeing where I can go with being an American, that some of my friends who don't have those same values because they just didn't have that pressure, I guess, of someone who was so fresh. And when you look at those lens of being fresh here, it's like going to another country. You see things so differently. When you're here so many generations, you don't have that same lens. And so that certainly has had a big impact on my drive.
I think kind of like what these two were saying about their fathers kind of driving them a little bit. It's kind of the same experience for myself. My dad was really kind of the one who would push me to do better or be better, and just to understand that I can be, this sounds generic, be somebody. And it wasn't until I came here is when I really realized that I can really actually make a difference. And so it also came from being in contact with like people who have graduated from here a couple years ago, them actually being leaders themselves and just trickling down the little information telling me, hey, you can do this, you can do this. You know, be yourself, make a difference. And that's what I've really learned about authentic leadership is just being myself and understanding that my whatever I do actually works. So I don't know if that makes sense, but.
It was a really good question because it just kind of underscored, I think, one of the points that I think I was talking about a little bit too, and I'm not surprised at all that we all, because I'm going to as well, referenced a relationship, a family member and a relationship that we had. And so I can point to my mother as well, but I also can point to sort of adoptive parents throughout my life, teachers and professors that I had, you know, in school, at the Mennonite schools, at the public schools, you know, Myron Dietz at Lancaster Mennonite High School, and Clyde Hollinger, and here at EMU, Al Keim, and Calvin Shank, and yeah, and others. You know, that it's those relationships that sort of create this nurturing environment. I think about that as an educator every day. Middle school children know whether you're scolding them or singing them a lullaby that you love them, if you do or you don't. They know. You know, when there are all kinds of circumstances and ways that we have to be boring adults to them and teach to them sometimes. And there's times where we have to be firm and apply discipline, although we're desperately trying to get a restorative discipline program operational in our city middle schools. Is a very, very painfully slow coming. But children know when they're loved, and I think that bringing up and that teaching is a different type of experience when there's love with it. I think London made that point earlier. You know that's about that love.
Thank you again for sharing. You talk beautifully about how your experience in Mennonite world and Mennonite education inspired your values-driven engagement with the world. I'm curious as to what your comments would be back to the Mennonite church that has sort of given you this leap and start in life into the world, but What is your hope? What do you see in the church itself?
Oh, in the church or in the school? Is it the church? That's a whole nother conversation. like the church, man. That's my New York. It's pretty blunt here. I think I'll start with the school. The church is a whole thing. The school, I would say for me, as someone who I studied bio, and I think the school system, in the last year and a half, I've been privileged to speak all across the country at different colleges and different high schools. And one of the things, as someone who's in tech now, that I'm really excited about is that I think the school in itself has to redefine what it means to major in something and how we label ourselves as being this thing, especially if you're not going into a profession that requires a certain skill set, like a lawyer or a doctor. So if you're coming out with a major, like for me, biology, it doesn't mean that that's who I am for the rest of my career. And I think the institution, the school, has to now re-realize that technology and the next generation, Gen Z, is no longer going to define themselves by just one thing. We're no longer going to have that one job. I mean, as a millennial, I've had 3-4 already, and the people coming behind me are going to have 10. I forget the number. So many more positions, so many more careers. And I think with the school, on the school basis, you know, one of the things that I wish EMU would have had, and I hope, in talking to Roxy, this is something that I'm happy to be a supporter of, is creating an incubator. So start thinking about how do we incubate ideas that aren't necessarily, that don't necessarily fit into the traditional model of what has been. There are other institutions now. I still have the Mennonite World that have had incubators for the last 10 years in technology, and are helping students who have great business ideas raise the capital, take a percentage of the company, and then help them create these businesses that could either be sold or become the next thing. And I think I really am excited about getting behind EMU on that, in that area, because I think it's a win-win for the college, a win-win for students, to really learn what it takes to run a business. Because you can sit in class all day, but the real world is very different. Whether it's going off to volunteer or whatever it is, the things that you learn outside of the classroom are tremendously impactful on how you on everything, on all the values that that you almost are faced with. And I think if you can start, if EMU can create for business particularly, if you can create that foundation, it could help mitigate some of the things that, for me and some of my friends who graduated, who just didn't have that support system here. And I think the church in itself, you know, again, that's, I'm going to let someone else speak about the church. I'm not an expert in that area. Anyone? See, I'm not alone.
I don't think my answer is specific to the church either, but certainly is inclusive of both the church and Mennonite education or Mennonite higher ed. And I don't think any of this is going to be kind of new information to any of you, but I guess just information that I would stress again. And I think just continuing to challenge ourselves to figure out how to be more inclusive and more accessible to a broader demographic of people. I think, I look out here and most of the folks that I see are white, which is great, but I also think, you know, these messages that we're talking about and these values that we're talking about are so powerful and so important, and it's kind of sad that it's still not a message that maybe feels welcoming or inviting, or a space yet that feels welcoming and inviting to a broader demographic of people. So I just, I would continue to want to see us grow in that direction.
I'll just second what Dominic was saying, and I will say that I don't have the answer, so I'm presenting a problem without a solution. but we're in a room of people that this is what we can do. I can only speak of Harrisonburg too, so I don't know if it's different in Goshen and different in Chicago and different in Lancaster. But I do not see the Mennonite Church. I feel like the Mennonite Church is really has a gap in making a meaningful connection to people of color here in this area. And so, I mean, that's the community that I work with. I have attended a Mennonite church, you know, for a long time, and just in the last year and a half, 2 years, I've stopped attending church altogether. And I do see there are other people of color where that's the relevancy of the message, the connection of the message, the format of the message, whatever it is, I'm not sure. And I'm sorry I cannot say, well, this is what you should do and this is what you should do. But I really think that there needs to be a serious look at what's going on. What are we doing or what are we not doing?
I mean, Rick and Dominique pretty much said what I was going to say. I just had a meeting yesterday evening, and we had just talked about, you know, what things we can do. And we had talked about just having, you know, people that look like me. I could probably count them on one hand how many people are actually working here that look like me, somebody who I can relate to, someone who's from like the same area that I'm from or can experience the same things I've experienced in my lifetime, which isn't very long. But just to have that figurehead or that person that I can go to and talk to say, hey, this is what's happening. Can you relate to it? Can you help me? Can you give me some advice? So just to have, you know, just that extra push to have more diverse faces on campus would be probably a big step in helping bring a demographic to EMU.
Values. Sometimes there's a clash of values. Some of you have talked about being in business circumstances where not everyone shared your values. And so the same guy who said, love your neighbor as yourself, also said, love your enemies. He also sat down and ate with people whose values were very different from his and challenged them on it, but within the context of eating with them. So the question is, what does it mean if we believe that our only salvation is our enemy's salvation? Our only healing is our enemy's healing? Our only success is our enemy's success?
The only thought I really have about that, thank you for your statement, really just borrow from David Schenck and Calvin Schenck. And I remember David talking in a forum about his work with the Muslim community and building bridges between Christians and Muslims. And this is when I was in college, and it was the first time I'd kind of seen that do unto others as you would have them do unto you passage in a very different light. So where we would hope that others would encourage us in our faith, encourage us in our walk, in our Christian faith, that we should also encourage others, even if they are of a different faith statement, encourage them in their walk, encourage them in their faith. You know, that idea of that, of what your story is and what your experience is, encouraging you in that. It really kind of just brought, I'm not necessarily saying that's what I believe, I'm just saying that sort of broadens my way of looking at that whole concept, you know, of the I'm the way, the truth, and the life, there's no way to the Father but through me passage, and juxtaposing that to that view of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Yeah, it just sort of broadens this idea of this eternal salvation payoff is for the purpose of it, which is the ultimate purpose of the Christian walk and the Christian faith. Yeah, so I'm getting into theology now, so, but not, the things I don't understand. So, but it's, yeah, that sort of, and I don't know if I'm really speaking to your point in the way you see it, but that's what it made me think of when you were commenting.
Well, we will have a whole time tomorrow to talk about a theology of leadership, so maybe that will help clarify some of these questions. But I want to thank our panelists for this evening, and I want to also reflect on some overall themes I've been hearing. One of the things, Dominique, you mentioned as marketing communications as a tool. And I think that's a theme for us as business, and leadership is a tool. And so I think Brian Welch was talking about as a tool for meaning and purpose in our lives, if we choose to use it that way. Peter Block would say it's a convening tool, leadership as a tool to convene and to be with each other. And tonight I heard a tool for authenticity, a tool to practice authenticity, to kind of be a solution as a leader, maybe as a leader of color, to be a solution for the problems that you see in the world. So tomorrow we're going to focus on a theology of leadership. And then we will have a time to a World Cafe here in Layman, where we're going to have all of you derive a collective wisdom for how do we lead in a divided society. So what is Anabaptism and what is leadership for a divided society? So we're going to facilitate that to end the conference. So we'll see you back here tomorrow morning at 8:30. Have a great evening.